night. I thoroughly enjoyed our time. I hope you did. And today I hope to look more in depth at the Rural Church of Christianity. Again, last night I said that these are really two of my very favorite topics. We talk about Christianity, the truth of the gospel, and what God has done and is doing in the Lord Jesus Christ by His Spirit through the church. And then to really intersect that with rural America and what the rural church, the very pivotal place, the value, the need for rural congregations. And so this is something that I feel very strongly about. I often told people until the day I die, I hope to be the thorn in many people's eyes as I continue to beat the horns on the rural church. So I'm really glad to be able to be here again this morning. As Bill began, really, we are structuring our time together around three questions. And last night was the question, simply, does Christianity have something to say to rural America? I tried to make a case, whether it was successful or not, that while the answer to that question is a very simple yes, it's not a question or an answer that we can take for granted. And that's because we live in a society, we live in a culture, where a lot of people and a lot of institutions have very little to say to rural America. Whether that's the government, whether that's the educational system, whether that is the economy, whether that's the culture around us, even many churches find themselves grappling with what to say to rural America. And the message, the overall message, I think that rural America often gets from our society is that rural America is really not worth our time. Rural America is not worth money, it's not worth our talents, it's not worth really considering because we have a society that is gravitating more to an urban center and a city mindset. But far from those mindsets, far from those opinions, I hope to have shown last night that even though rural America is a little place, in a place of very little significance and importance, that Christianity has something to say to rural America. That Christianity, since its very beginning, especially at the beginning of the New Testament church with Jesus and the apostles, has emphasized the place that small towns and rural areas have. And we saw, especially last night, from the life and the ministry of Jesus. Just a quick reminder, by way of review, Jesus was, for all intents and purposes, a small-town boy. He was born in Bethlehem. That's significant. Bethlehem, whatever our romantic ideas are of Bethlehem, it was a very small town. Jesus grew up in that community of Nazareth, a place of very little reputation, a place of very little influence, and yet that name accompanied Jesus throughout his life and ministry. He was Jesus of Nazareth, which identified him really as, for, if I can use the expression, he was a backwoods boy. Jesus was from a small town. He was seen, came out of a small area, an area that was reputable for nothing good coming out of it. And yet that was the identity of Jesus. And we saw that Jesus ministered in small towns, that Christ actually identified in Mark chapter 1. The very reason he has come is to preach even in villages and in small country places. And we saw that Jesus' will for his church, for Christianity, is that it embraces even rural areas. That something that is simply obsessed with the city, we long for Christ to be proclaimed in the city, but not exclusively in the city. In Christianity, Christ's will for his church is that we would go into small areas. And we saw that reflected in Acts chapter 8. When Peter and John are in Samaria, and in Acts chapter 8, verse 25, we find that they are traveling around and they are visiting many villages, many country towns, hamlets is the way that word could be interpreted, and they were preaching the gospel in those places. So the question last night, does Christianity have something to say to rural America? And the answer is emphatically, yes, it has something to say to rural America. This morning, I want to move to the second question, and that is simply, why does Christianity have something to say to rural America? Why? Why is it that Christianity has something to say? I was reading a book recently on some of the sociological aspects of rural America, and I came across this quote that I thought was insightful and actually applicable to the way in which we need to be thinking as the church. The author said this: it is a well-observed sociological law among all population groups that no social organization to meet human needs begins until those needs that have long been felt and perhaps keenly perceived by individuals here and there are brought into the consciousness of the people as a whole. To interpret that very briefly, the author was saying that every institution around us in society that is seeking to meet human needs can only do so after those needs are perceived and after those needs are felt. And there is something very true to Christianity in that principle, that when we come to think about the work of Jesus, when we come to think about the gospel, first and foremost, we need to feel and perceive the need that the gospel addresses. So when we come to this question, why does Christianity have something to say to rural America? We need to take an honest evaluation of the needs that are present in rural America. We need to talk about what rural America looks like. And that is a point that is well worth, I think, reflecting on and meditating on. A man by the name of Nathan Brown has written, actually an edited book where he has compiled many different essays from authors. But in the introduction to his book, the book is titled Challenges for Rural America in the 21st Century. This author, David Brown, makes this point. Most Americans form their opinions about rural people and rural communities from a distance, through literature, art, and music, but not through direct experience. The true nature of rurality, that's a great word for you, the true nature of rurality, the worldview of rural people and the conditions of their lives, is often at variance with the typical perception of most Americans. He is saying that most people around us get their idea of what rural life, rural communities, rural people, most people get their ideas about what rural America is like from a distance. They learn about it through literature, they learn about it through art, they learn about it through music, but very few have learned what rural America is like through experience. And he rightly points out, and many people have done the same, that there is a great difference between the way most people perceive rural America and the true condition of rural America. And we need to get an accurate picture of the needs and the way in which rural America looks and the struggles that are present if we are going to be able to answer the question, why does Christianity have something to say to rural America? And so in our time together this morning, that's really where I want to go. Well, I want to begin then by telling you about the first time that I visited Winchester, Kansas. So Winchester is now where I am. I've been there for coming up on 7 years. My family and I love the community. And yet, our coming to that community was a little interesting, to say the least. I told you last night that in 2009, my family and I moved to Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I began seminary training. Grand Rapids is a fairly big city. In that time, it was also made all the bigger because Detroit was really struggling economically. And everybody fled the eastern part of the state, and they tend to gravitate towards the western side, which is where Grand Rapids falls. And so Grand Rapids is one of the fastest growing cities in the United States. And in many ways, Grand Rapids was not equipped or ready to deal with such a population boom, which adds to the chaos of living there. But my family and I have been living in Grand Rapids. We have bought a house. I'm not sure why. I don't know if that was the smartest move or not. But we bought a house and thought, you know, we're going to be here for a few years, so let's not pay rent. Let's put down some roots and let's start living here in this community. Now, suffice to say that our house was in a bit of a bad neighborhood. I have many stories, some of them comical, some of them heartbreaking. I remember one morning, I think it was a June morning, I woke up and we had a big picture window in our living room that looked out to the main sidewalk on our street. And I was sitting there doing my morning stretches in this window, and this woman came walking by, and she started grabbing everything in my yard and just piling it up in her arms. And I knocked on the window, and she was surprised not only to see me, but I was only in my pajamas. And she looked at me, and I looked at her, and she ran down the road with all my possessions tumbling out of her arms. That was the neighborhood we were in. That was a comical story. There are some tragic stories. I remember waking up one morning and looking out that same window, and just across the street, this young woman was surrounded by 9 men, and one of them started punching her. And I immediately called the police. I've never seen a police response like that. They were there literally within 20 seconds. There were patrol cars. It wasn't the best neighborhood. And we had children at that time. The Lord had blessed us. We had 3 children. We now have 5. But, you know, as parents nervous, you know, we got to keep an eye on our children. They can't walk outside very much. They can't be on their own. They can't play out there all day. And it's just not the best of neighborhoods. We have a fenced-in backyard. You know, we had to have padlocks on everything. Nowadays, I leave my keys in the ignition of my car. I actually almost lost my keys in my truck this morning because I'm used to leaving them in the ignition. And I went to lock my door, and I realized, wait a second, my keys are still in my car. So, but this was life in Grand Rapids. There were busy sidewalks. There were very busy streets. It took me 25 minutes to drive to my seminary, which was 5 miles away. And there was a lot of noise. And my wife and I were not terribly thrilled to be there, but it was what it was. And in January of 2012, as I was getting ready to finish seminary, I got a phone call from a person in this community called Winchester, Kansas. And he said, hey, we're looking for somebody to come and preach to our pulpit. We got your name. We're wondering if you'd be interested in coming to visit. And I thought, sure, you know, when do you want me to do this? And they said, well, you know, could we schedule it 6 months in advance? Could you come out in June? And in January, that sounded like a great idea. So I was like, yeah, that's fine. You know, we'll do it. That's great. and as the weeks wore on and the months came and suddenly June was lingering, my wife said, aren't you going somewhere? And I said, oh, yeah. I'm going to Winchester, Kansas or something. And she's like, well, where on earth is that? I don't know where it is. And so we pulled up a map and we found out that Winchester is in the middle of nowhere. It's in northeast Kansas. It's an hour away from Kansas City. It's an hour north of Topeka. And it's in the middle of cornfields. And I started looking online. I thought, well, here's this community. Wow, a population of 500 people. And I started to have this thought, you know, this is going to be a great visit. And I actually tried to find a way to get out of having to go. Because I just thought, you know, why do I want to go to Winchester, Kansas? But all my plans were foiled, and I had to meet my commitments, and so I think I said last night I flew into Kansas City, and I was driven over to this small community of Winchester, Kansas, in the middle of nowhere. And I had a delightful weekend. It was a busy weekend. I preached twice, and during the afternoon, one of the men in the church let me sit in the front seat of his pickup truck, and we went around to look at cornfields, which actually was quite entertaining. And so I got all the small town gossip, and I remember that night, it was Sunday night in June of 2012, and after church got over, I returned to my host's house. They had a big patio in the backyard. Their backyard just opened up to cornfields for as far as the eye could see. Corn had been planted in the field that year. It wasn't a bean year, and the corn it had a pretty good growth. And so we were sitting there. We were just sitting on the back patio. And we were watching the sun slowly dip beneath that cornfield horizon. And slowly twilight, you know, it was actually a very nostalgic scene for me. And the twilight began to turn to dust. And the silent chorus of fireflies began dancing over the grass. And there was this gentle breeze that blew, and the stars began to come out, and there was the chirping of crickets. And I just remember sitting there thinking, my goodness, this is the life. Like, this is amazing. And I remember I got on the phone with Maggie Hink when I was getting ready for bed, and I called my wife, and I said, honey, I don't know what we have to do, but we have to move here. This is like the perfect place. And I said, you know, this is like a little slice of heaven on earth. It is my own little perfect haven. And so my wife and I returned home, and a couple months later, we were able to go out, and, you know, this romantic idea that I had of Winchester was quickly destroyed as she drove through the town. I came to love it as well. And I remember having that idea of Winchester. It was a naive idea. It was a very romantic, nostalgic idea. And it was this idea that rural America and this community is really a haven and a safe place from the busyness of the world around me. And I think it's fair to say that many, many, many people have that kind of idea of rural America. When you read novels that talk about life in rural America, wherever it is, it's really an idealized picture. You think of the way in which rural America is often portrayed in the media, in television and in movies. It's always picture perfect. You think of the older generation, I only watched it as reruns, but you think of Mayberry. And you think about all the things that happened there and really idealize this idea of small town living. You think of the artwork that is out there, whether it's photography that happens to capture that perfect moment on the horizon, or you think of paintings that really put forth an idealized version of what life in the country is really like. I think the idea that many people have of rural America, very picturesque, it is postcard perfect. It is the idea that life is better and more serene and more peaceful as it is lived in the country. And the question is that really what rural America is like? Friends, if rural America is a Norman Rockwell painting, then I would suggest this morning that Christianity wouldn't have much to say to such a perfect life. If rural America is this romantic, nostalgic idea that we have, it would be hard to find a reason why Christianity has something to say to rural America. But when we begin to live in the reality of it, as I think I'm probably going to be speaking to the choir this morning, rural America is a place filled with problems. Deep, deep, deep problems. Now I want to go back this morning just for a moment to Acts chapter 8. We began looking at some of that last night in Acts chapter 8, verse 25, where again we have Peter and John. Peter and John being two, arguably, of the most significant of the apostles, if you can rank the apostles. You have Peter and John, and they are in Jerusalem, and they get word that God is doing something remarkable in the region of Samaria. And so Peter and John go to the region of Samaria to figure out what's going on. We've heard these good reports. They see for themselves that the gospel is making inroads in this region. They stay for a while. They preach the gospel. They have this interesting encounter with a man named Simon who wants to pay for the Holy Spirit. They rebuke him. And after they meet there in Samaria, we read in chapter 8, verse 25, "Now when they had testified and spoken the word of the Lord, they returned to Jerusalem, preaching the gospel to many villages of the Samaritans." And last night, we emphasized that word villages. It's a word that means unwalled city. It is a word that literally translated means a country town or a hamlet. It is the idea of a place that is not influential politically, culturally, economically. But Peter and John spend time in those villages preaching. And we read in verse 25 that they are preaching the gospel. We're going to get a little more into the gospel in our second session this morning. But gospel, if you're not familiar, that word just literally means good news. And the picture that we have is that Peter and John go into these villages, into these small country towns, and what are they doing? They are preaching good news. They are bringing good news to those people that live in those communities. And we might ask the question, well, why? Why did they bring good news to these communities? And the answer is simple. The answer is because these were villages and communities that had been touched by bad news. They were communities that had problems. They were communities that were steeped in bad news. In fact, if we were to go back this morning and look at the beginning of Acts chapter 8, where the very first person to begin preaching the gospel in Samaria is a man named Philip. And then we read here in Acts chapter 8 that Philip went down into Samaria and he proclaimed to them the Christ. And we read that the people began to pay attention to what Philip was saying. That Philip, as was common in the very early days of the church, that his message was accompanied by signs and wonders. And in Acts chapter 8, verse 7, we read, "For unclean spirits, crying out with a loud voice, came out of many as he had them, and many who were paralyzed or lame were healed, so there was much joy in that city." You see, the picture that we get of Samaria, just in those few words, here's a place that has bad news. Here's a place where people are suffering. Here's a place where people are sorrowing. Here's a place that needs joy. Here's a place that needs good news. Here's a place that is dominated by spiritual darkness. And Philip comes, and he preaches to them Christ, and Peter and John come, and they return to Jerusalem, preaching good news to many of these villages in Samaria. And they did so because the Samaritans lived in a world and in a place of bad news. And friends, that remains true today. Why does Christianity have something to say to rural America? Christianity has something to say to rural America because rural America is a place that is filled with bad news. It is not that picture-perfect, postcard-perfect idea of Mayberry, where all is well in the world. Rural America is a world dominated by bad news. And we need to look honestly at what is going on in rural America. This is going to paint with very broad strokes, what I hope to do is both to give some statistics, but I don't want to just remain at statistics. I'm also going to spend some time talking from personal experience. But I am going to paint with broad strokes. Whether rural America is defined by those places in Appalachia, which are suffering a great deal, to the logging and the fishing communities, perhaps in the Pacific Northwest, to Midwest farming communities, I'm going to paint with broad strokes, but what I want us to begin to understand is that rural America really is still with bad news. And this isn't something that simply, as Christians, we are able to recognize. This is something that everybody seems to be recognizing. In May of 2017, the Wall Street Journal, not a paper that I frequent, just not very interested in it most of the time, but in May of 2017, so just a couple of years ago, an article was written by a man named Paul Overberg. And even the title and the subtitle of that article is very telling. The title of this article was, "Rural America is the New Inner City." And so those of you who might be old enough to remember, in the 1960s and in the 1970s, there was a tremendous movement in American society to address the overwhelming problems that existed in the inner city. The inner city began to get all kinds of attention in all kinds of different ways. And these authors are noting that what the inner city was in the 1960s and 1970s, rural America has become. That rural America is the new inner city. That since at least the early 1990s, it has been rural America that has replaced the inner city as some of the most troubled areas by key measurements. That's what that article was about. And it's an insightful article, it's a useful article, and it is telling us, it is not just Christianity that recognizes there's bad news in rural America. Everybody recognizes it. Rural America is far from native. Like I said, what I want to do, I'm going to rattle off some statistics this morning. It's interesting that when I first started thinking and reading about rural America, I found all kinds of depressing statistics. And I returned to those statistics year after year. They're not getting better. They're getting worse in some ways. And so I want to look statistically at some of the things that define rural America, but I also want then this morning to talk a bit about personal experience and the way in which my naive idea of my own community was shattered by coming face to face with many problems. So let me begin with some statistics. What are some of the leading statistics today with regards to rural America? Well, first and foremost, one of the most important statistics is simply this, that rural America is a place of tremendous poverty. In July 19, 2019, so just a couple months ago, David Swenson wrote an article that got a lot of attention. And it was titled, "Much of Rural America is Doomed to Decline." And he was writing about the future of rural America and the way in which it is, economically speaking, beyond saving. And he noted in that article, to quote him, "Since the Great Recession, most of the nation's rural counties have struggled to recover lost jobs and retain their people. This story," he said, "is markedly different in the nation's largest urban communities." It has been noted by many people that in that Great Recession that we experienced in the last decade, most of the government aid went to urban centers. Almost none of it went to rural communities. So that rural communities who are already struggling simply have not recovered from what we have now called the Great Recession. Poverty is a reality in rural communities. Some other statistics regarding poverty. At the turn of the 21st century, one in five rural counties had a poverty rate higher than 20%. Today, so that was at the turn of the 21st century. So within 20 years, it has changed. So the turn of the century, one in five rural counties had a poverty rate higher than 20%. Today, one in three rural counties, that's 657 counties in the United States, have similarly high rates of poverty. That is a study that was based out of Penn State. From a demographer, Brian Thieves. Another statistic, according to the United States Department of Agriculture, in 2017, almost 23% of rural children in the United States were poor. And that is compared to 17.7% of urban children. So there's a difference there of 6% more children in rural communities are living in poverty compared to those in urban communities. In March of 2017, an article that PBS published, they know that census data shows that the rural job market is smaller today by almost 5%. Than it was in 2008. Again, according to the United States Department of Agriculture and their Economic Research Service, based on 2017 data, the poverty rate in rural Kansas is almost 14%. And that is compared to the poverty rate in Kansas's urban areas is 11%. I noted the book last night, but a book that's gained a lot of attention in the last several years, a book titled Hillbilly Elegy by a man named J.D. Vance. you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. J.D. Vance is a young man, not much older than me, and it's a memoir that he has written. He grew up in Appalachia, there in rural Kentucky. And while I think it's really ambitious for a 30-something-year-old to write a memoir, most 30-year-olds should not be writing memoirs, this one is very well written. And J.D. Vance sets out to really describe what he calls the culture crisis of rural America. Now, just a quick book review for you. Descriptively, J.D. Vance does a phenomenal job really describing the poverty that exists in rural America. Prescriptively, he's completely not helpful. And he admits that in the conclusion of the book, after descriptively going into great detail about what rural America looks like in family, in morality, in poverty. He admits that the problems are very hard to know exactly how to address them. But one of the observations that he makes in that book, and he does so well, is that government assistance and government programs of the larger welfare state have, for decades, utterly failed in rural America. They have done very, very little to alleviate the poverty and the problems that exist in rural America. And so statistically, as we think about rural America is a place of profound poverty. And I know that sometimes that's easy to write off. We live in a first world nation. And it's easy to think, you know, yeah, poverty for a first world nation is nothing compared to the way most people are living in the world. And while there's an element of truth to that, it is true that the poverty that is being experienced in some rural areas is almost as severe as the poverty that exists in third world countries. And I bring that statistic up this morning simply for this. We'll be looking in our next session at what Christianity says to rural America. But to maybe whet the appetite, or you can see where I'm going to begin going with that. Poverty is not an issue that is irrelevant to Christianity. We're not about the thing that we call the social gospel. Jesus himself taught, the poor you will always have with you. But again and again and again and again, the scriptures emphasize a tremendous mercy for those who are oppressed and those who are impoverished. The church, at peril to the commands of God, ignores those who are in poverty. And rural America is a place defined statistically by poverty. Well, another area of statistics for rural America that helps give us at least a statistical picture of rural America are the statistics relative to substance use, to drugs and to alcohol. It's no secret. Our society today is being overwhelmed in epidemic proportions by drug abuse, by alcohol abuse. These are things that are leading some of the most serious problems in the society in which we live. And this is true of rural America. And in fact, most of the statistics show that the drug and the alcohol crisis of our day and age is greater in rural America than it is in our urban counterparts. And my goal this morning is not to always pit rural America against the city, but these are statistics that we have to deal with. For instance, a fascinating book by a man named Nick Redding is a book titled Meth Land. And Nick Redding went and lived for a number of years in a very small community in Iowa. Most of the time, well, I don't know what you associate with Iowa. I was born and raised in Minnesota, so I'm not allowed to like Iowa. We were always told Iowa means idiots out wandering around. But besides the natural hostility that I have towards Iowa, many of us think about Iowa as one of those quintessential rural states. You've ever driven through Iowa, it's beautiful. The cornfield is as far as the eye can see. But Nick Redding went to a small community in Iowa, a population not more than a couple thousand, and he chronicles in his book titled Methland the devastating effects that Methodists have on this rural community. And it's really just a small snapshot of a much greater problem. Sadly, today, meth use is almost synonymous with rural America. Meth is a huge problem in small communities. In 1999, California led the United States in meth lab seizures. In 1999, California had more meth lab seizures than any other state in the United States. And in 1999, California had three times the meth lab seizures of the state of Missouri. Fascinatingly, within 5 years of that statistic, by 2004, that ratio was reversed. And Missouri, which is primarily a rural state, has three times the meth lab seizures that the state of California has. Think about that statistic for a moment, and you begin to realize the epidemic that meth is for rural areas. According to the Addiction Center of the United States, starting in 2006, rural rates of fatal drug overdoses surpassed those of urban areas. Even as they note that urban centers were hit hard by the effects of the opioid epidemic, they note, the Addiction Center notes, that rural regions continue to experience higher and higher rates of substance abuse, particularly to alcohol and methamphetamines. So that's the Addiction Center saying that rural rates of fatal drug overdoses surpass those of urban areas. USA Today, in an article dated December 14, 2016, said this: study reveals that rural areas see an increase in babies born with opioid addiction. In 2013, the neonatal abstinence syndrome, which is a syndrome that is caused when pregnant mothers use opioids and babies are born with lifelong effects to that. In 2013, neonatal abstinence syndrome was 80% higher in rural areas than in urban areas. And that has increased sevenfold since 2004. The U.S. Department of Education notes that rural areas are much more likely than their urban and suburban counterparts to use and abuse alcohol. And the U.S. Department of Education has found that in rural America, children begin to abuse alcohol at a very young age. 80% of school teachers in rural communities report alcohol as one of, if not the most serious problem in the school district. And that's compared to 61% in the inner city. 80% of rural teachers say this is a serious problem, compared to 61% who say alcohol abuse is a problem in the inner city. Fascinatingly, I wonder if you know where our nation's greatest outbreak of HIV happens. Our nation's greatest HIV outbreak did not happen in an urban center, but in a small town in southern Indiana named Austin, Indiana. Austin, Indiana has a population of 4,295. And in the last decade, Austin, Indiana had the worst HIV outbreak in U.S. history. 5% of their community became infected with HIV due to the use of shared needles. And so that small town was devastated by the effects of substance abuse. The CDC regularly reports that there are rising rates of deadly overdose in rural America, and that these continue to grow exponentially year by year. The statistics on substance abuse in rural America are crystal clear. Rural America is suffering under an epidemic of drug and alcohol abuse. And as we're going to begin talking more in our second session this morning, drug abuse is an addiction. It's very complex. But the spiritual side of that is that drug abuse is a worship problem. It is an idolatry problem. And the church needs to be aware of it. Another statistic that helps give us a picture of what's going on in rural America are the statistics related to suicide. And I know that you need to deal very sensitively with this topic. Just last year, I met with many other people in my community for suicide response training. And it's a very serious issue. It's a very sensitive issue. Probably even in this room this morning who have not been affected by the realities of suicide. So suicide is not nearly a statistic. But the statistics of suicide in rural America are heartbreaking. In 2018, suicide was the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. And in 2018, suicide was the 8th leading cause of death in the state of Kansas. Between 1990 and 2010, in a 20-year period, suicide rates increased 42% for women and 40% for men. In 20 years, we have seen suicide rates increase almost 50% among men and women. The greatest demographic of people who are apt to commit suicide are, perhaps surprisingly, white males. White males, middle-aged white men, account for between 70 to 75% of all suicide deaths. Tragically, the greatest suicide risks occur in states that have the most rural populations, including Wyoming, Arkansas, Montana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Kansas ranks near the top for states that deal with suicide. Kansas, our state, has a suicide rate that is higher than the national average. And suicide in the state of Kansas grew by 6% in the years between 2016 and 2017. And again, statistics are showing that suicide is a serious problem in rural America. That rural Americans are committing suicide in greater numbers than those in the city. And I think it's rightly been pointed out, it was in World Magazine, Anthony Bradley, a number of years ago, rightly pointed out that, again, suicide, at the end of the day, a complex issue, but it reveals something, doesn't it? I remember in trying to pastorally learn how to deal with the reality of suicide, somebody once said something to me that has always stuck with me, and that is that people don't commit suicide because they want to die. People commit suicide because they don't want to hurt anymore. And when we read the statistics of suicide, and the statistics of suicide in rural America, what it really does reveal is a deep, deep hopelessness and a deep despair and deep depression that exists in many of our communities. We move on from the statistics of suicide. You can even look at the statistics of mortality. According to the CDC, there are several demographic, environmental, economic, and social factors that make rural residents at a higher risk of accidental death. simply to interpret that, according to the CDC, it's more dangerous to live in a rural area than it is to live in the city. People die tragically and accidentally more often in small town communities than they do in urban centers. According to the CDC, infant mortality rates are higher in rural areas than in our urban counterparts. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, unintentional injury deaths are much higher in rural than in urban areas. And according to the National Advisory Committee on Rural Health and Human Services, there is a growing disparity in the United States between the life expectancy of rural people with urban people. Simply put, urban city folk are living longer than rural people. And I don't want to make too much of all of this, only to say that rural America, with these types of mortality rates, is just pointing out the obvious. Rural America faces the reality of death. And death is an issue that Christianity speaks to. And my point in all of this, in these statistics, is not just to ramble off a bunch of statistics, but to say that the statistical picture that we get of rural America is that rural America, far from a Norman Rockwell idea, is a place filled with bad news. But of course, behind the statistics are real people. Behind the statistics are hurting lives. Behind the statistics are broken families. And I think it's useful to move simply beyond the statistics to experience. Because the Winchester that I experienced that evening when I was sitting on the patio and the fireflies began coming out is very different than the Winchester I have now come to experience only in 7 years. So what is my experience of rural America? Well, I remember one of the very first people to show up at my door when I was a pastor was a man who was addicted to meth. And he had just been released from the county jail, and he had clear eyes, and he was thinking rightly. And he said, you know, I really want to begin living life the way that I should. And I and some other pastors in the area got to know him and invested time in him, and it was only a matter of weeks until he was addicted to meth again. He went back to jail. He came out with clear eyes. 2 weeks later, he was addicted to meth again, back in jail, came out with clear eyes. And the repetitive pattern of this man's life is simply addiction, breaking the addiction, addiction, breaking addiction. And he is now serving, and I don't know exactly what he did, I think he shoplifted, but he's serving significant time in jail. I haven't talked to him now in quite some time. The reality of the opioid addiction in rural America. I remember one day sitting in my study, and then I got a knock on my door. My study's in my house, and a man was standing there, and you could just smell the whiskey on him. He said, "Pastor, I need help. I'm totally drunk, and I live a life of drunkenness, and I need some help from you." I met another man in my first 2 years. Who worked for the local ambulance service. And it was discovered that he was sneaking the drugs that they administer to people and using them for himself. And he was immediately let go from his job. He was put into an addiction center. I got called and he said, you know, I need somebody to meet with. I need a sponsor. Can you come and talk to me? Another woman showed up at my door one day. And she just showed up. I had never met her. She lived in my community for 9 years. And she was in tears, and I invited her in, and she sat on my couch. And come to find out in time that she's a middle-aged woman suffering from schizophrenia. She doesn't have the resources to help her through that. And that morning she woke up, and the voices in her head were telling her to kill herself. I sat there with her on the couch, talking to her, trying to affirm her, encourage her towards safety. She's a woman who continues to come to our church today, but battled these things on a daily basis. I got a call one day from a family in town whose son was accused of sexually abusing a woman and found guilty in the courts. And I found myself for a time interacting with him and with that family, and in the grip and in the middle of his sin, the reality that here's a man who has ruined the life of a little girl. I got a call one day. One of my members is a funeral director, and whenever a family's looking for a pastor to officiate a funeral, he tells them to call me, and I don't know if I'm thankful for that. I am thankful for that. But I got a call from a family just 3 years ago, a young woman at 22 years of age, had four little children, decided to go to her friend's house one night and drove home drunk and went through the windshield of her car and died. And the family was looking for a pastor to officiate the funeral. And I had to sit there and look at her four children in the front row, and I'm a very empathetically emotional human being, bawled my eyes out, and talk to them about the reality of life and death. Less than a year later, I got a call from her family again because her dad had died from a drug overdose. And I officiated the funeral, and during the funeral, there was an open mic time for people to come and share their memories and their experiences, and the only person that came forward to share his memories with this man who is now deceased could only laugh and talk about how many drugs they had done together and how fun it was to lose their minds together. I had somebody show up at my door this summer who said, "Hey, Pastor, what's your experience with drug-addicted suicidal people?" I always thought, as I'm married, you never let your jaw hit the ground. You always take things in calm, measured responses, but I wanted to let my jaw hit the ground. I have almost no experience with drug-addicted, suicidal people. But a man in our community who was struggling with just that. There's a man that lives a few houses down from where I live, whose mind is completely fried. He's in his early 40s, and he has nothing going on in his brain. And the reason is because when he was in elementary school, his brother got addicted to drugs and mixing drugs, and to figure out if they would be fatal or not, he made his brother be his guinea pig. And this boy, from an elementary age, fried his brain on experimental drugs and now lives in our community a broken, broken life. A couple of years ago, I got a phone call from somebody in our community. They were worried about a friend and asked if I could go check on them. It was the middle of winter, and she wanted me to go check on her because she had heard that in my town, this woman was sleeping in her car in the middle of winter because her car formed a better windbreak than her house, which was dilapidated and falling apart. This woman had no utilities, and she was indeed living out of her car, and our church got involved as much as we could and had a welfare check, and eventually the house had to be torn down and was condemned. But here in the 21st century in Winchester, Kansas, is a woman who in the month of February is bundled up with blankets, sleeping in her back seat because she doesn't have the money in order to pay rent. On that, and maybe we can talk about this more later, what a tremendous opportunity for rural churches to exercise diaconal ministries. My deacons in my congregation, I love to brag about them, this last year have spent almost $6,000 helping people in our community. $6,000 to help those who are impoverished. In July, I got a phone call. A young woman in our community just graduated a year ago, was riding an ATV with her friends. She rolled it in a ditch and she broke her neck. And they were looking for a pastor to come and to speak at a candlelight service on the school grounds the day after her death, and I was reminded there once again of the reality of life and death in a small town, and this family that now needs to walk through a very dark valley, family that has no hope in the Lord Jesus Christ. In September, I just got back from vacation with my family. We had gone camping for 2 weeks. I was mowing my lawn, and I got a call from a father in our community. He said, "Kyle, something really terrible happened this afternoon." And I said, "Well, what's going on?" And he said, "My son left school today, and he tried to commit suicide." And I said, "Well, is he okay?" He said, "Yeah, thankfully, it didn't work. But he won't talk to me about it." And he said, "The only person he's willing to talk to is you. Could we come and talk to you?" And so 2 hours after this boy tried to kill himself, he was in my office on my couch, and we were crying together and weeping over the realities of life. I had a woman show up at my door one day in tears. So what's going on? And she said, "Pastor, I had an abortion 20 years ago, and I have struggled with the guilt and the weight of that. My dad made me get it. Is there ever going to be forgiveness for me?" I have dealt more than once with people in the community struggling in the depth of depression. You begin to add to that the very harsh realities, the number of young women in our school district who cut themselves, the number of young and old addicted to pornography. You deal even in Winchester, Kansas, talking to my high schoolers the other day. They told me the LGBTQ issues have become a popular thing in school. Many of their friends deciding to identify as bisexuals or as lesbians or gays. You deal in a community with people who have shattered family lives. A couple of years ago, I got a call from a woman in our community. And she was a single mother, and she, in some ways, was trying her best. But she has a high school son who has no respect for her, completely disobedient to her, has major anger problems, was threatened to hit her. She said, "You know, Kyle, my son remembers you from the BDS program 5 years ago that you did. He's always loved you. Would you mind being a male influence in his life because he has no one?" Right, a reminder of the shattered home life, the broken families that so many people experience in these small communities. You know, all of this, just some of the experiences that I've had in my community that has shattered my perception of a perfect little town. And all of this happening, my town is 7 blocks by 7 blocks. I can sit on my front step on the north side of town, and I can literally see the other side of my community. And in the midst of that, 7 blocks by 7 blocks, are people struggling with drug and alcohol addictions, people who have learned the tragedy of death, people who are living in poverty, people who are suicidal and find no reason to live, people who have been sexually abused. You see, the point is, I mean, many, many of you can probably relate to this. Rural America is not unaffected. It might look nice. We might have ideas of a postcard perfect place, but there is a lot of really, really bad news in rural America. And people argue, the scholars and the experts argue until they are blue in the face, trying to figure out why is it that rural America is suffering in these ways. Some of them blame capitalism. Some of them blame the educational brain drain. Some of them blame government and politics and inequality and federal policies and programs. But you see, here's my point this morning, is this, that the Bible actually interprets these things. And the Bible tells us exactly what is behind it all. Behind all of these things is the reality of sin and the misery of the world in which we live. And as people who live in rural America, as people who see these problems, we cannot look at the society and the culture and the community around us and think everything is all right. It bears the marks. Our small communities bear the marks of sin and misery. And the scriptures tell us why the world looks this way. In Romans chapter 1, the Apostle Paul tells us why the world looks this way. It is because the world does not honor God. The world does not thank God. The world does not acknowledge God. The world does not worship God. The world has, as Paul says in Romans 1, exchanged the truth of God for a lie, worshiping the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. And rural America is a commentary on that spiritual reality. You see, Winchester, this place that I call home, peaceful as it appears to be, is not untouched by the sin and the misery of this world. And we need to remember that. You know, one of the attitudes that I try to combat sometimes as a pastor are our parents, who act as though our small community is a really safe nest to raise their little birds in. And that the day is going to come when those young people need to grow up and spread their wings, and something I continue to hear from parents is, and get into the real world. Remember when I became a pastor, an experienced pastor in my own denomination said, you know, I'm really excited, Kyle, for you to go to Winchester. What a great stepping stone. What a great training for real ministry. And I thought to myself, training ground for real ministry? A training ground? And yet many people treat our small communities in that way. It's a stepping stone to the real world. And if I can be blunt to say it this morning, it betrays a terrible understanding of what the Bible means by the concept of the world. Because rural communities are not immune and safe, and in a nest of safety from the realities of sin and misery. Rather, sin and misery, the things of this world, have worked their ways deep into the lives of rural communities. And you see, this is precisely why Christianity has something to say to rural America. Broken, and it is shattered, and it bears the weight and the burdens of sin and misery. So does Christianity have something to say to rural America? The answer is an emphatic yes. And why does Christianity have something to say to rural America? Because rural America is a place where the curse of sin resides. And as the church and as Christians, that is our primary focus.